This is the Horse Radio Network.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
This is episode 329 of Horses in the Morning for December 31st. I am Glenn the Geek from Ocala, Florida. Happy New Year, Horse World! This episode is sponsored by Kentucky Performance Products. As you know, we are on holiday this week, and today we have for you my four most memorable interviews of 2015. A couple days ago, we did Jamie's. Well, today it's my turn. As tomorrow is the 1st of January, we will not be doing a show tomorrow, and then we'll be back live. You can look for Jamie and I and Jennifer back live on the 4th, on Monday. We'll be back, and Jamie's supposed to be going to an event with Thor this weekend, so I am sure she'll have stories to tell. Don't forget that the Rose Bowl Parade is tomorrow. Put your DVRs on and record it. You'll hear Karen, you'll hopefully see Karen from the Horses in the Morning Endurance episode every month, and her friends in the endurance community there in the parade, along with, I think, 12 or 14 other equestrian groups. HGTV is what we found the best place to watch it at, HGTV, and it's on New Year's morning, so you'll want to record that. I hope you enjoy my picks as my most memorable interviews of 2015. Well, Wendy, we were heading back from vacation on Saturday. Funny story about this. And we subscribed to Audible, and we love books on tape. And we said, let's look for a book. And I said, well, there's that Sergeant Reckless book that came out, and I was fascinated by that. So we looked it up, and it was on Audible. It's written by Robin Hutton. So we listened to it the whole way home. And it was a great, terrific book. A lot of research done to this book, and I didn't know a lot about the author, and you learn a lot about Robin in this book, and what happened before and after the war and the whole thing. It was really a good book. It made the trip home go so much quicker. And then I got home, and ironically, I had this email the same day from Angela from Horse Girl TV, our friend Angela. And she wrote and said, you've got to have this person on your show. She wrote the book Sergeant Reckless. So Angela was emailing us the same time we were listening to it in the drive.
That's so funny. It's fate.
I was fate. And I said, well, then I definitely have to have Robin on. So we do. We have Robin with us today. She is the author of this book and an unbelievable advocate for this horse. Robin, hello, good morning, and thank you so much for joining us.
Well, good morning to the both of you, and I'm sure happy you enjoyed the book. And Angela is just a delight, and I had a lot of fun with her last week when I was back at Camp Lejeune. And so thank you so much. I hear the audiobook is wonderful. I have not had a chance to listen to it, actually, I hear Susan's voice does a beautiful job.
She does, and you know, Audible books are really dependent upon the person who does the reading.
Yes.
And if you have a terrible reader, they're not going to like the book. It's just the way it goes. You know, and I.
Yeah, that would be terrible.
Yeah, I know. You write this great book and have an awful reader, it'd be terrible. And, you know, this was a book that really the reader was important in the Audible one because it's written with, you wrote it with such emotion. And it is an emotional story and an emotional book,
it
and
is.
She really conveyed that. So you can give her compliments from us. And I've stopped books
I sure
before,
will.
So you know, good job. But now you,
great.
I got to congratulate you, and I want to thank you.
Oh, thank you.
You know, we have many members of our family that are in the military. My co-host Jamie, who's off today, and Wendy's kind enough to fill in. Her husband is a fighter pilot, so you know, for you and my dad was a Marine and during the Korean War. So this book meant a lot.
It hit home for you.
Yes, it really did. And I wish he was still alive because I wanted to ask him about the horse. He never mentioned it. Now I want to ask him about it.
But, I know.
You wrote it in such a way that really told the story from the beginning to this horse died, and then after, to your efforts to have the statue built and everything that went into that, all of your hard work. And thank you for doing that hard work and for really, you know, making this horse a place in history where it should be.
Oh, well, thank you for that, Glenn. You know, it has been an honor and a privilege to have this horse be such a part of my life over the last 9 years, and I just thank God every day for it, I swear. The people that I have met along the way that shared with me their stories and their pictures and everything, it has just been an incredible ride. And no pun intended, but it has just been amazing. And, you know, she is just this incredible little horse. And, you know, she's as real to me as if she'd be grazing in my backyard.
Well, Robin, if you don't mind, I would love to play the audio from your book trailer. Because
I think
it tells the story better than you and I could in those voices. And
oh my!
Are the voices we hearing in here, are they actual Korean veterans? In this,
I don't know because I haven't heard it yet.
Oh really? From the book trailer? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a listen. Yeah. All right, let's take a listen.
Wonderful.
This is the true story of Reckless, a small Mongolian mare that became the greatest war hero horse in American history. How great? In the 1990s, Life magazine published a collector's edition of America's 100 greatest heroes. Included among such colossal giants as Washington, Lincoln, Jefferson, was a horse. Believe it or not, Reckless was named as one of America's 100 all-time greatest heroes. Named for the 5th Marines Recoilless Rifle Company, also known as Reckless Rifles, this 5-year-old mare was purchased at a Korean racetrack for $250 to help transport ammunition for the company. The Marines trained her to step over communication lines, get down when there was incoming fire, and to ignore the sounds of battle. During the fight to retake Outpost Vegas in 1953, she made 51 trips on her own to the firing sites. She carried over 9,000 pounds of ammunition and walked over 35 miles through open rice paddies and up steep hills through artillery that was exploding at the rate of 500 rounds per minute. During one of these trips, Reckless shielded 4 Marines who were moving up to the front line, and she was wounded twice during the battle. But that didn't stop her. After the war, the Marines brought her to Camp Pendleton, where she was fed and maintained by the Marine Corps in lieu of retirement pay, according to official Marine Corps documents. Reckless was promoted twice at Camp Pendleton, first to sergeant, and then in 1959 to staff sergeant. Her last promotion ceremony included a 19-gun salute for the Marine Corps commandant who presided over the ceremony, General Randolph Pate. In her honor, there was also a parade of 1,700 troops from her old outfit, the 5th Marines. She died in May 1968.
You know, that really gives me goosebumps because after listening to the book, you know, and hearing that and hearing those guys talk, it really does give me goosebumps.
It gives you goosebumps. I mean, I'm crying.
I know you do, and I'll tell you who that is. I didn't know that you were playing that when you said the trailer for the book. That voice is Tom Laughlin from the Billy Jack movies. Do you guys remember Billy Jack in the 70s?
Yes,
it was
the
iconic. Yep, that was Tom, who I worked with for 35 years until he passed away in December of 2013. But yep, he loved this horse and this story, and he I made that video back when nobody knew about her, and I was trying to get the world to know about her, and he did just a great job on that, and I love that video. It makes me cry every time I hear it.
Me too. I actually stumbled across it one time when I was doing some research for the Driving Radio Show, and I said, my God, Glenn, we have to get Robin on. This is incredible.
Oh, my gosh.
So yeah, I'm glad we're finally talking to you.
Me too. It's just a great story. You can't beat the story. And to me, it's the greatest horse story I had ever heard. And actually, I had never heard about, you know, and I'm like, why? How did she vanish from the pages of history? And
yeah, because
you know,
she was hugely popular in the 50s. I mean, she was hugely popular.
Yes, famous with Blassie and Rin Tin Tin back in her day, and yet she vanished.
Well, you know, too, and I think what struck home to everybody and what struck home to us, because we're all horse people, right, that are listening to this, is we can't teach our horses, we could not teach our horses to by themselves do a round trip that was a really far long away in fire, and I am sure that the North Koreans and the Chinese had this horse targeted. They wanted this horse dead.
They became her herd. The Marines became her herd. She was the only animal in camp, and so she needed a herd, you know, because that's what horses are, herd animals. And so she would follow them anywhere, and they always took such great care of her, and they loved her, and she loved them. And I like to say she wasn't a horse, she was a Marine, because she became really one of them, sleeping in their tents at night and drinking beer with them and eating in the mess tent with their coffee and the eggs and everything. And so it was hard to find really where the horse stopped and the Marine began, because she became so close with them. And so she would follow them anywhere. She knew what her job was. She was an incredibly smart horse. And she knew what her job was, and she did it loyally and faithfully without ever hesitating.
You know, when you get a really good mare, that's what they are. They love you, and they want to take care of you, and they're incredible. And in the video, too, you can see how when she's doing her job, when there's all this fire around, and she's climbing up a mountain with all this weight on her, her little ears are forward, and she just is chugging along by herself.
Yeah. Oh, I know it. Harold Wadley, Sergeant Harold Wadley, who saw her during the Battle of Outpost Vegas, her most heroic battle, he said that he saw her struggling in the flare light. He said there was so much incoming and outgoing firepower, they couldn't mark it. It was just a blur on the screen. And he said they would collide midair, causing these aerial bursts that looked like the 4th of July raining down on the troops. And he saw her struggling to get up that hill in that flare light. And he said it's an image that has been imprinted on his head and his heart forever. He will not forget that. And he also says there must have been an angel riding on her back that day for her to make it back safely. And she was wounded twice. She ended up getting two Purple Hearts, but neither one of the wounds put her out of commission, and neither one of the wounds made her stop or hesitate in any way to complete her mission.
Right, you'd think after she got wounded, she'd be like, I'm not going up that hill again. But it's such a great story.
You guys, go ahead.
You can go do this. I don't get paid enough.
Right, exactly.
Wendy, I'll tell you what. Wendy's a veterinarian, and Wendy would not have approved of her diet in camp.
Oh, I know.
No, that's not true, because I'm all about variety in your diet.
Well, she got variety. A lot of beer, alcohol, eggs, anything humans ate, she ate.
That's good. See, they're following a Chinese medicine diet.
Yeah, there you go. And she also loves cherry pie. There's a wonderful story. I won't be a spoiler alert. When the cook made the cherry pies, and he put them out to cool, and he came back, and the centers were out of all of them.
Oh my God!
You know, she just—I know it. I know it. It's crazy what this horse
she loved,
would eat.
She had good taste too. She loved donuts. That was the other one of the other things she loved.
That's not on a good Chinese diet. Donuts.
No, and Hershey bars. I guess she would eat a little bit of chocolate to also help with her energy. Joe Latham fed her that and everything. they loved her, and she loved them.
It must have been so nice for the soldiers to have that horse down there, because it kind of added some relief to them from the horribleness of war. You know, you have this relationship with an animal.
Yeah, I agree. She was also, she was like a mascot in that regard, you know, where she, however, she's, you know, she's the only animal to have an official ranking in any branch of the military. She was officially promoted to those rankings and everything, even though she served, you know, as a mascot in that way of, you know, helping the men get over what they were, you know, she added a lot of levity. Right. And that was just a wonderful thing. Maybe even a little bit of back home, you know?
Well, right. You know, it was interesting too, and I found interesting because if anybody knows anything about the military, you they're not really open to new things. Let's just put it that way. And especially from the general on down. And this horse had the support of the generals that were in charge of the war over there. I mean, it was incredible the amount of support she had all the way to the top.
That's absolutely true, Glenn. You know, it's really cute when you think about it. Her battlefield promotion in Korea was done at the time he wasn't a general, but I think he was a colonel, Rand McCall Pate. And he, on April 10th, 1954, promoted her to sergeant in Korea. And they had a big fanfare there. They built a stage for her. They did it appropriately, as if she was like at Camp Pendleton doing it. And in 1959, when he was commandant, he gave her final promotion to staff sergeant. He went out and he had a 19-gun salute in his honor, and 1,700 troops paraded in front of her to show their respect and admiration for her and everything. It's an amazing story.
It is. I don't want to give away the ending either, what happened after she got back here to Camp Pendleton, or you guys have to pay attention to the trip that she had from there to here, because that's quite a story. But
oh, I didn't even think about that.
That's so I'm not going to spoil anything. Don't spoil it, Robin. Let them listen to that, because and we can all picture that happening, being horse people, right? So
you know. Oh my gosh.
But then you took, and you have done a massive effort and, you know, put a ton of money out of your own pocket and spent a lot of time trying to get a statue built. And done. And you did that. You accomplished the goal. And I know it was with a lot of heartache, but I just have to tell you, it is an unbelievable statue. Jennifer will put it in the show notes and on our Facebook page. It is just incredible.
Oh, yes. Jocelyn Russell out of Friday Harbor, Washington, did a majestic job in capturing Reckless going up to the guns during, it's called an uphill battle. And it's during the Outpost Vegas battle that she was in. And man, when we had 3,000 people show up for the dedication at the National Museum of the Marine Corps, the Commandant of the Marine Corps, General James Amos, who actually writes a foreword for my paperback version of my book, which just came out last week, does a magnificent job. But people gasped when the monument was unveiled. It was like she was in full motion going up to the guns. And it has been just an incredible labor of love. And we're now trying to get one placed for her at Camp Pendleton, where she lived out her days and is buried. So she's going to be bi-coastal. And then we also, a couple of weeks ago, got the heads up that there's a province in South Korea that is building a museum, and they want to place one of the monuments for her there, just south of the DMZ, where she fought during Outpost Vegas. And so Reckless will be having a place of honor there as well, because the South Koreans are very, very proud of the fact that she was a Korean horse that became such a part of American folklore and, you know, the Marines' history.
Well, I know you put a lot of work into this. There's still a fundraiser going on too, right? Because I know that you had to borrow, beg, and steal to get the money to build this and to get it done.
I know. You know, and it was really interesting. You know, I can still remember sitting in the executive director's office 5 weeks out of the Marine Corps League. This is the Marine Corps League, their executive director. And he's sitting there, and I'm trying to get a donation because I'm saying, you know, Mike, the Marine Corps League needs to be on the plaque, because like for $5,000 donation, you get your name on the plaque to be on there forever, to be associated with this. And they had just built this monument for Chesty Puller there, and he was still trying to get that paid off. He said, Robin, I can't do it. He says, but tell me, how much do you need? And I said, I need $45,000. And he says, and you have 5 weeks to do it. And I said, and I have 5 weeks to do it. And he looks at me and he says, you've got guts. And I said, Mike, I don't know how it's going to happen. All I know is that I'm going to get that pony to the show, and I'm going to make it happen. And sure enough, By the grace of God, my mother stepped up and lent me the money, but I had actually was able to pay her back by December 1st because people saw the monument and how beautiful it was, and they wanted to be associated with it. And so now we're doing the same for Camp Pendleton, and yes, we are still raising money for that one. And I'm still waiting for final permission from the Secretary of the Navy's office, which should be forthcoming in the next couple of weeks, because it's going to be breathtaking where we have her there. So, but it's a lot of heartache and stress and worry. But you know, I just knew it was going to happen. I just knew it was going to happen.
You should be a staff sergeant in the Marines after all of this.
Right. I feel like I'm a Marine. You know, all of my friends that have, you know, that I've met and gave me, you know, their stories, their family to me now. You know, and. And sadly, they're starting to pass away, and I've lost three of them since I started this mission 9 years ago. Well, and I've made it my mission for life that she's never going to be forgotten again. And so it's just been this wonderful, wonderful, joyful experience.
Now, with the dedication of the statue, I assume that you had several of the Marines that served with her there, too.
Oh, yes. I had about a dozen of them. They came with their family members, and some even brought some of their friends to be a part of it. And General Amos went over and shook the hand of all of them. And it was just such a great day. And I remember...
They had to have tears, Robin. They had to be crying when that...
I'm crying again.
It was crazy.
I'm crying again,
yeah,
too.
It was... Oh, my God. It was just crazy. You know, they had... I was there a couple of days early, you know, to get things set up. And three of the guys came in... early because they wanted to kind of do some sightseeing and, you know, get situated and stuff. So I took them down to the monument to show them the monument, you know, a couple of days beforehand. And oh my gosh, my one friend, Johnny Newsom, his eyes, his face was so red. He was trying so hard not to show the tears when we turned this corner and he saw her standing there with in this beautiful pose carrying her ammunition up, and these guys just couldn't keep it together. They all just cried these tears of joy, and you could see how proud they all were. All of the guys that were there were so proud to be there and to be a part of this wonderful piece of history.
Well, I just I'm sure they all appreciate your efforts too. You got me crying now. So,
no, you know what else I love about this story? We don't have a lot of stories that touch your heart like this about horses that don't end in complete disaster. And this has a really happy ending. And I love that.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. Me too. And thank goodness, you know, like so many people said, am I going to cry? And I said, well, yeah, you will, because it's, you know, people, you know, it's war and, you know, everything. But she does survive the war. So I'll tell you that.
Yeah, we're not, yeah. That's not a spoiler. That's not a spoiler alert. You know, that's just a fact. So it's like, you know what?
I know,
I got to say, if you're listening to this while driving, have tissues handy and, you know, be prepared to pull off the road. So
I know it's just a great story. And thankfully I didn't screw it up too badly. But
no, you didn't at all.
You know, you just can't beat her story.
I'm glad too, and I'm glad of this. I'm glad you continued to tell a story. I'm going to call it the prologue. I don't know if you called it that, but I'm glad you continued to tell the story after the story, and that was you and the statue.
Because
that was as fascinating to us, being in marketing and sales and stuff. That was as fascinating to us as the story itself. And I'm glad because you know. You could have been proud and not told that part, but I'm glad you did.
That was my publisher's idea. You know, he wanted me to do that. And I'm like, oh, you know, I've never been one to, you know, tell my story. It's not about me, you know? And he says, no, but this is about you, you know, and it's about your journey with this horse. And it's because of the love for her that, you know, I wanted to do what I did. So that was his at his urging, and Regnery History has just been a fabulous publisher, and they've just taken to the story just phenomenally and have done so good by me and everything. So I did that, and it was quite interesting when I was pulling it together, you know, and I had forgotten a lot of the things that happened, as you do, you know, when you're in the heat of the battle. And but it was a pretty interesting ride, to say the least. And So thank you for that. That's very kind of you to say.
Sergeant Reckless. It's SGTReckless.com. SergeantReckless.com is where you can find it. If you want to contribute and help out with the fundraiser, information's on there. If you want to buy the book, you can find links to it on there as well. I'm so happy we had a chance to have you on, and thank you.
Oh, I'm blessed. Thank you
again to Angela from Horse Girl TV. She's been friends of ours since we started the Horse Radio Network. So,
oh, she is awesome.
We appreciate her. So I assume she did a story. Is that going to be coming out on, let's give her a plug, on Horse Girl TV too? Is it out yet?
Yes, she is. Yes, she. We just did it, so I think she's probably editing it. I'm not sure exactly when it's going to be coming out, but yes, we had a wonderful sit down and everything. She's just a joy and everything. And there's also, I want to, also my friend Templeton Thompson, who's a country singer.
Yeah, she's been on our show 100 times.
Oh my gosh. Tempe, she wrote this beautiful song for Reckless called Ooh-Rah Reckless. And you can find that on her website and also on mine. And we have a Facebook fan club for Sergeant Reckless as well, that people can go and get caught up on some of the happenings and different pictures. And when I new things come along, I post on there and stuff. But yeah, Tempe did a beautiful song for Reckless, and very, very proud. I'm going to get that in my movie, Camilla High Water.
Well, I know she'd appreciate that too. I'm trying to find it actually on her website, because we play a song right after we hang up with you. And I had forgotten that she had done that. So I will try and locate that, and we'll play that today.
Oh, that would
I'm
going
to need to go get some tissues for the rest of the show.
When you hear that song, you will. I mean, I get the chills every time I hear it. So it's just beautiful.
It's called Ooh-Rah Reckless. Is that the
Ooh-Rah Reckless.
I don't think we've played that yet. So we're definitely going to have to, I'll find it. I'll find it during the commercial, and we'll play that song. Thank you so much, Robin. We appreciate you.
Thank you so much. It was awesome, you guys. I really appreciate you guys taking the time to talk to me about my favorite pony, and I'm just really grateful for it all. Thank you so much.
SergeantReckless.com. Thanks, Robin.
She swallowed hard as they walked into the start box. She could feel his muscles tense under her leg. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Have a great ride. She didn't have to ask. He galloped out of the box and across the field toward their first training level course. His ears pricked. Her heart pounded. He attacked each obstacle with confidence, clearing them with room to spare. A huge smile broke out on her face as she crossed through the finish flags. She leaned forward and buried her face in his neck. Their bond of love and trust blocked out all else. This love story is brought to you by Elevate. Research proven to have superior bioavailability. Elevate supplies the essential vitamin E often missing from the equine diet. Its all-natural formula supports healthy muscle and nerve functions. The horse that matters to you matters to Kentucky Performance Products. Call 859-873-2974 or visit kppusa.com to order today.
Well, good morning, Potato. Thank you for joining us, and a great big congratulations to you on your win at the 60th anniversary of the Tevis Cup.
Thank you. You're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
How are you feeling?
I feel great.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself. When did you get started endurance riding?
In 1972, I was living at a place that was incredible in Sacramento called the Ranch Apartments, owned by Paige Harper, who had won the Tevis a couple of times, and he had 9 buckles.
Wow.
And I saw that buckle. Ranch Apartment was, he had the ranch house there as far as ranch, and he had a 10-unit apartment building. Each apartment was a 2-bedroom unfurnished with a carport and one stable in the barn, a 10-stall barn.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
And an arena and everything. And we used to ride out of there over to the Horseman's Park, over at Horseman's Association, where we practiced and rode and so forth. So one day I saw that buckle of his and the emblem on the back of his car. And I said, what is that all about? And he told me about the Tevis Cup. I said, I want to do that. So he helped me. I went out and bought an Appaloosa he helped pick out for me from a guy named Ratty Monero. And Ratsey was a famous horse trader in those days. The first time I got on the horse, he bucked me off right there in the barnyard. I got back on him and rode him around a little bit, and I liked him enough, so I bought him.
Of course, we always buy the first one that bucks us off.
That was funny. Anyway, that was my first, and that was, so that was my first attempt at Tevis. And that was my Tevis was my first endurance ride.
No, really?
Uh-huh.
Well, everything seemed easy after that, right?
Well, it wasn't easy because I rode that at horses. His name was Bandit, and he could detect the upgrade better than a civil engineer. Everything about him was right. His confirmation, he went well, he was easy ride, everything except for he was an Appaloosa that didn't want to go uphill.
Aww.
And now they just don't quite have what it takes to do what I want to do. So first year I rode, and when we got down there at the suspension bridge and going up that out of that canyon, he quit. And I had to work him. I mean, I had to practically take his shoes off and carry him up that canyon, the devil's thumb. And when I got up there, I was bushed, beating that horse and getting him to go up the hill, you know. So they pulled me at devil's thumb, and I was so happy to be spoiled, I couldn't believe it, because the horse wore me out. So I thought, well, he just needed more conditioning. So I worked them even more. And I worked there out of Paige Harper's place, and Paige and I would drive up to Ruby Park, Ruby Point, rather than ride there and so forth. But after Tevis, I just rode. I kept riding and riding, and I went and did the VC 100. Vic, that's the ride in Nevada, 100-mile ride. And I rode that with him, and it took me 23 hours and 45 minutes, but I finished.
Good.
He went like mad until we got to the first vet stop. We were in the top 10, I think. And we left there, and he looked up there and saw those Clark Mountains running out of the 102 Ranch. And he said, look at that, 5 hills. I'm not going up there. I fought him. Every one was a major battle. And we got to the top. He go down the other side, like the lickety-split. But going up was a problem. I remember one time up on the top of about the fourth hill, I'm sitting there resting on a rock, and I was exhausted from getting him to go up the hill. I mean, every 10 feet, he would stop. I would literally have to go back and push on him or beat him or whatever, get him to move. I'm sitting on a rock looking at him, and all of a sudden, I hear the rattle, rattle, rattle. There's a rattlesnake sitting there. Wasn't no more than a meter away from me. And I looked at the snake, and the horse looked at the snake, and I said, get him. About that time, I was ready to push the horse off the canyon. I was riding Paige Harper's Steuben's saddle, not Steuben, but a McClellan's saddle. I figured I'd take that saddle off and carry it down the hill and just knock this horse off the canyon. I was so tired of working with him. And along come Joel Giroux, who was riding Appaloosa as well. And he and I got together, and we went down the hill. On the bottom of that hill, it was the last one, was Roe Bailey. And she was happy to see us. She was crewing for me. And she gave me a bottle of Four Roses. And Joel and I just started drinking on that Four Roses and took off and went the rest of the way. And every now and then, he just went because there's no more hills like that, you know.
Okay. So wait a minute. I was going to ask you later on what the key to being a successful endurance rider is, and you've answered bourbon.
It was Four Roses, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that wasn't really the key. That was the key to surviving that day. Anyway, we ended up, it took all day, 23 hours and 45 minutes. So we finished, and I was happy to do it. And so then I thought, well, you know, he still was not, I mean, 23 hours and 45 minutes is not a good ride, right? So I kept going with him, and I took him up to Cow Mountain, which is a 50-mile ride in Ukiah, California. And I rode him there, same thing. I mean, I got down on the ground once and looked and it didn't look like it was an upgrade, but it was. He's not going to go. And that was it. I got to get rid of this horse. I sold him to a family as a trail horse. Not an endurance horse, but it's a trail horse. And they were happy with him. But about a year or so later, Dr. Barshall called me up, and he said, or rather, the people wanted to sell the horse, The potential buyer who lives not far from here, now we're still good friends, they called Dr. Barcelo and they say, we want to buy the Appaloosa that Potato was riding in Tevis. What are you thinking? He said, oh, no, that's not a good endurance horse. But they bought him. It took them 5 attempts to get him through Tevis. But they finally did it. And meanwhile, that was the end of Appaloosa for me. And I bought a mare named Eden's Kalana, Roll Bailey, who provided me with the substance to finish the BC 100, which was my first 100-mile buckle, by the way, and my second endurance ride.
Wow.
She found a mare for me called Eden's Kalana, and that was my first endurance horse, and she turned out to be the foundation stock for all the horses I've been breeding all these years. And she's awesome. She lived to age 34. We finished the Tevis in 1978, came across the finish line first. But because they were in groups of 10, 2 minutes apart, we ended up losing them the ride by 2 minutes to Kathy Perry. Kathy Perry won. Anyway, she turned out to be an incredible horse.
Well, tell us about the horse you rode this year.
It was a great granddaughter of that mare. Mm-hmm. That's Philouette, who's out of Fia de Kalana, and of course Fia de Kalana is out of Fia, out of Kalana. So that's Philouette. She's 14 years of age, and she's a big mouth. She talks a lot, and she argues with me sometimes. but we get along just great. I love her. She gave me two girls of hers. I have Fia de Maison, who's out of her by a horse named Abu Maison, who is a champion horse in the show ring owned by the Gearharts, Andy and Joe and Judy Gearhart. So that's Fia de Maison. The other daughter of hers is owned by Margareta Doms, who lives next door to me. I sold her to her a few years ago, and she loves her. She was awesome. So that's Philouette. And she's the character. She's just as fun to ride as you can imagine.
And how many times has she been through the Tevis?
You know, I don't really know. She's done it a lot of times.
Okay. And you've completed 22 times yourself?
Yeah, 22 times.
Okay.
Last year, Philouette came in 6th place, ridden by a girl from Norway. And a few years before that, the year before that, she came in 7th place by a girl from the Netherlands.
Okay.
Wilhelmina DeBoer. And when Lena from Norway rode her last year, she says, well, I got to be at least 6th place. And that's where she ended up, 6th place. And a week after Tevis last year, after coming in 6th on Tevis, I took her over to the High Sierra Classic, which was only a week later, and rode that ride with. And when we came in 3rd, and I firmly believe we had a good chance to win because I had a lot of horse, but the last 20 miles of that ride, I left the noon vet stop out front, but the trails were a little bit confusing because the cows were eating the ribbons.
The ribbons, mm-hmm.
Not that much to eat up there, and they were chewing off the brush with the ribbons on it. So I was not sure where to go, and two ladies come out, and they knew the trail. The last half of the ride, we rode together. And I had so much horse, it was fun. They were nice riders, nice girls. And about 2 or 3 miles from the finish line, I still had plenty of horse, believe me. And they knew that. They could see how she was going. And I could see that there was a three-way finish. So I said to those girls, I said, listen, ladies, last week, you know, we did this Tevis Cup, and she came in 6th. So this is a 50 mile. We should come in 3rd. So you two decide who's going to be 1st and 2nd, and I'll be 3rd. And they did. They were happy to do that. And
good.
One of them got BC, and the other one won.
Oh, good.
And so that was fun. So I knew I had plenty of horses. So this year, a week before Tevis, 2 weeks before Tevis, I was going to do a 50-mile ride up in the Redwoods. And then time has interference with other things. I didn't do it. So the week before Tevis, which was 2 weeks ago, I went up to the Hack Creek Hustle and rode her on a 50 on Sunday, the Sunday before Tevis. And she was awesome. That was a fun ride. And we won that and got best condition.
So do you know at a certain point, you've won so many races, do you know at a certain point that it's going well, I'm going to win this?
No.
No?
No, not really. Well, yeah, you know, when I left the quarry vet stop last Saturday night, the only one horse was in, and when I left, there was no one out and no one else had come in, and that horse wasn't saddling up. So I thought, well, I got a few minutes on her for sure. And I didn't know she was not going to leave that vet stop.
Uh-huh.
So it's only 6 miles to go. You know, I got a good chance now of winning this. But you never know. I've seen horses come out of the dark, you know. And so I just kept, I moved as quick as I did all day long, a steady pace. And I waited. I made it. It turns out that horse never left the vet stop.
How do you stay in shape? You're 72 or 3. I've seen different reports on that, by the way. Do you know how old you are?
I'm only 72.
Everybody has you at 73. They have you older than you are, actually. Potato.
I know.
So how do you work out a lot, or you just ride a lot? How
no,
do you
not
stay
a lot.
In shape?
I work out 3-4 times a week at the gym, and that's about it. And I usually, my regimen, normally I like to be in the gym around 5 a.m. And I could work out and then get on my day. I used to have a watch that has a timer on it, a little Sony watch, and I had it set for 5 a.m. When that went off, I wanted to be in the gym. And sometimes it'd go off on the way to the gym, but I generally made it by 5 a.m., sometimes a little earlier. But, and I still do that. As a matter of fact, I'm a little upset right now because I haven't been in the gym since last Friday morning. And that's because I had a little bit of a rough weekend.
Yeah, I wonder why.
And the only rough part of the whole day was getting around a dead tree that was across the trail. I climbed up around it, and I ended up falling and slipping. I fell a good 20, 25 feet.
Oh, wow.
Slid down at a steep angle, rolling down the hill.
Was that just before Pucker Point?
It was just before the Pucker Point.
I remember that tree.
That tree was something, and I'll tell you what, I was hurting. When I rolled down that canyon, if it hadn't been for the trail, the land on the trail and rolling off the other side, I would have been. I had visions of my demise. I really did.
Wow.
And I was so out of breath, I couldn't ride. And my mare was standing. I had to go around that stump. I went up above to go around it, and when I got up there, I tripped and fell. That's when I come down, and I fell on the ended up on the trail. I finally got up, and she was up there looking down at me. She said, I'm not coming down there. That's too steep. It was steep. I finally got my reins that were hanging down on the ground from her and dragged her down. She came down once I tugged on her. But I couldn't ride for quite a while. I walked quite a distance. I was so out of breath, I couldn't get on the horse.
Oh, wow.
Once I got on her, we took off. I got to Deadwood, and no one had arrived yet, and I was ready to leave Deadwood. That's checked when heart riders started coming in. That's how much lead I had on him. And
wow.
I didn't feel any pain. I was just at the adrenaline, you know.
Uh-huh.
So I felt pretty good. As I was leaving Deadwood, one rider, number 4, who came in second, by the way, she was ready to leave, too. And somehow she got vetted through, and she was ready to leave. And I took off, and I never looked back, and I thought she was right behind me. But I rode that whole canyon across the suspension bridge. I went through the river. I didn't go across the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Across the river and up the other side. I got almost the Devil's Thumb. And 3 or 4 switchbacks down, I saw her. I thought, oh, darn, there she is. And I just squeezed Philolette, and she just trotted a little faster. And we went into at Devil's Thumb, got a drink of water, and had a couple of drinks of water myself. And left there and went over from Devil's Thumb to Deadwood. And we were leaving Deadwood when she came in.
Okay.
What time we had. We recovered. I took her saddle off, checked through, and vetted through. Put the saddle back on. I was about to leave when I saw her come in.
Mm.
And I left. I never saw her again. I think the next time I saw her was, maybe out of Rough Forest Hill.
All right, Potato, before we run out of time, I got 2 questions that the listeners wanted to know that they sent me requests for, okay? The first is, how the heck did you get the name? And I think there's a lot of people want to know that, so...
My brother Cabbage picked it out, I think. But he says it was Onion. But when I was born, onion wasn't at home, so it had to be cabbage. My father's name, all the boys got vegetables for middle names.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So it's really your middle name?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
And the girls were named Flowers, so it's not a big deal.
Okay,
and
so tell us what...
Yeah,
what are all
the
names?
To me, I grew up that way. I never knew any different.
Right, yeah.
Well, tell us what all the names are of your brothers and sisters.
Oh, God. The oldest boy is Onion. Onion and then Cabbage and Rutabaga and myself and Carrot.
Huh.
And the girls were Flowers. But, you know, that's not such a big deal. It's just people, you know, if you go to a foreign country, they don't think it's unusual.
Right.
Well, the de Terre in France and Garfunkel in Germany and so forth. It's not a big deal.
Well, the other listeners want to know, Potato, and this is your fellow competitors, actually. A couple of them have requested this, is when you're going to retire so they can finally win something. They want to know.
Retire? I've never had a job. I had a job once. It was the worst day of my life. And I never thought about retirement. I don't even know what that means, quite frankly, because they have a job of 40, 40, 40, they retire from that, but they still have work. You know? There's no such thing as retirement, really. It's a state of mind. It's just like age. Age is just a number. You know? Because someone is 72 doesn't mean they're old, but it's just a number. How old are you in your body, and how old is your mind?
Mm-hmm. I think that answers the question, and the answer is you guys are going to have to put up with Potato for a long time to come. So
let me tell you, I have a little filly who's out of Filouette. She's out of Fifi, who won the Tevis 10 years ago. So and every one of these horses, I've carried them in my arms the day they were born. Fifi won the Tevis 10 years ago, and I bred her to Garcon, who finished Tevis third place. And he's a Mezzatel grandson. When he was born, by the way, the mare laid down to have him. He didn't come out. She got moved around, that was Fifi, or Fia, rather. She's out of, Garcona's out of Fia. She laid down on both sides. He wouldn't come out. She got walked over by the fence and stood there in the fence, and he came right out while she was standing up into my arms. And I bred him to the Fifi, and the foal from that is called Filant. Filant Dior, out of Fifi Dior. Filant is so incredible, I can't believe it. I wanted to ride her Saturday. But, you know, I'd already set up to ride Filouette, and she was ready to go. And Filant has not done a 100-mile ride yet. But she is just so awesome. I get goosebumps riding her. She's like her mother and her father and the rest of her. So you can imagine her bloodlines. She is lined up for Tevis next year.
Filant. Oh, good. So you've got horses lined up for a while, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah. I got plenty.
Good for you.
I still got a nice daughter of Filouette that's just awesome to ride. And I got another mare who's the mare I won on a few years back named Fayette, the Shaggy mare. I have another one very similar to her. That mare, by the way, was out of a horse I bought from Gearhart's and by Garcon, or by Oman, who's the sire of Garcon, too. And I have a full sister to that mare. Not a full sister, a half sister to that mare I won on, the Shaggy mare. And her name is Sia. La Princesa Sia. She's a Shaggy. And she's only 7 years old. And God, she's awesome. I haven't met her back yet.
Well, Potato, we're just about out of time, and I just want to thank you again for coming on the show and talking to us, and congratulations again.
Well, thank you. And by the way, I didn't go to ride Saturday to win. I just rode to get the best ride I had.
Well, you had a really good ride.
It was fun. I could write a book on that experience.
You should.
You should, Potato. Why haven't you written a book yet?
I'm working on one.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And my book, I plan to have it out by before Christmas.
Well, you let us know when it's done, and we'll have you back on, and we'll talk about it.
Yeah. I've got a full team of people help me write the book, a biographer and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, I can't wait to read this one.
I'm seriously working on it every day. I spend at least an hour.
Oh, great. Wow. Well, that'll be fun. I can't wait. You let us know. We'll have you back on at the holidays, and we'll talk about it.
Hey, I'd be happy to be there. And then, you know, Karen, I watch for you on the trail, but I don't have eyeballs in the back of my head.
Oh!
I didn't see anybody behind me. Oh, yeah. I don't look around that way.
Oh, that's a slam, Karen. Yeah, that was a slam.
That's okay.
I just don't look behind me. I just keep going and do the best I can with what I got.
I don't look back either.
No.
You got to keep looking forward. You got to look where you're going.
There's something negative about looking back. Never look back. Always look to the future.
And we, of course, are coming to you from Disney today on International Podcasting Day. Welcome, everybody. If you're a first-time listener, we hope you stick with us. And if you get a chance, you know, podcasts, one of the wonderful things about podcasts is you can go back and listen to all the past episodes. Now, I calculated that out. We have 4,300 episodes that we've done on the Horse Radio Network. And if you listen 24 hours a day, it'll take you almost a year. So if you want to go back and listen, I recommend probably spreading that out a little. I don't want to listen to that much of me either. No. So we have Dr. Wendy Ying here with us, and we are talking to Carrie, who we have nicknamed the Little Boss. And we have a Robin here as well, who is the zoological manager. And we're talking a lot about the history of what goes on here. Now, Robin, you told us yesterday, and I love this saying. Go ahead. What'd you tell us?
Well, you know, they always say it all started with a mouse, and we acknowledge that it did, but we like to say it all started with a horse.
Yeah, there we agree.
Because they say that Walt's first paying job ever was drawing his neighbor's horse, Rupert.
Oh, wow.
He was paid a nickel, and he did a sketch of Rupert for his
neighbor. Isn't there a copy of that in the museum down there?
There's a representation of what it would have looked like, or what, you know, we interpret that it would have looked like, certainly.
I want to talk more about Walt and the history of the training and how the horses all started, because there's a very famous California trainer involved in all of this, too. And, we talked about this yesterday, and I think this is something the younger generations, I grew up in a generation where we watched Walt Disney doing the Sunday night, you know, and we saw him introducing all the movies and everything, but that's lost now. If you're under 40 years old, you know, everybody knows it's called Disney World, but I bet you there's some that doesn't even know there was a Walt Disney. It's kind of, Walt's kind of getting lost in the picture, and I think that's sad. And I don't know if I was supposed to say that today, but that's just, I want to talk about him because I don't want him to be lost in the picture.
Right. And, you know, we certainly don't want him to be lost either. And you're right. You know, we were very lucky in growing up that we all got to watch the wonderful World of Disney.
Sunday night. As a kid, you didn't miss that.
No.
And that was the one night we were allowed to stay up past like 8 o'clock to finish the movie.
I know. And I remember arguing with my parents. They would say, right when the movie was over, go to bed. And they'd be like, no, we need to watch the few scenes. We needed to see the few scenes of what was going to happen next
week.
Disney, because that came after the commercials. And you're right, the kids don't, you know, necessarily have that opportunity. But, you know, that's not what we as a company want to have happen. Mm-hmm. So, you know, here at Disney World and, you know, some of our different properties, we do try to preserve the history, and I'm sure we'll continue to do that, you know, by offering various tours and things, and tours through our barn, which we do offer, and, you know, just try to make sure that it does live on, and that people know that there was a man behind all of this.
And there was two men, actually, out in California when all the animals were brought in to start the Disneyland. Tell us about the other one.
Right. You know, Walt was, you know, always, you know, he was the passion, the idea man behind everything, but he also was, you know, very passionate about the people that worked with him, and, you know, very close to them. And he always said that it takes people to make this dream a reality. Right. And he understood that. And, you know, a friend of his had seen a man by the name of Owen Pope, and Owen was performing with his six little pony hitch. He would travel around the West California, you know, all through the state of California with this little six pony hitch. And one of his
colleagues, pulling like little beer wagon,
like
type
little show
things.
Wagons that would have advertisements of different things. And, you know, he also had a trailer business. He kind of,
He made horse trailers?
He made horse trailers. He was a welder by trade, and that was just one of the things that he did. It was Pope Trailers, and he kind of kind of mastered this bumper pole technology. And so he was using the pony hitch, going to these different rodeos and state fairs and parades, these kind of hometown parades, kind of promoting that. And a colleague of Walt's saw them performing and told Walt that he needed to go and see this guy, that this is what he thought Walt had in mind for, at that time, this park that he was planning. So Walt went and saw Owen perform with his ponies, and shortly after got in contact with Owen and his wife, Dolly, to see if they would come to California and start the horse program at his park,
right,
which of course later we know became Disneyland. And Owen and Dolly accepted the invite, and they came and they lived on the back lot of the studio in Burbank,
because originally
that's where the park was going to be, on a parcel of land close to the studio. Walt's ideas quickly outgrew that parcel of land, and they moved out to Anaheim. But that's what Owen was tasked to do.
And he was pretty well known in that area as a trainer and a horse person. And I know that because I've heard his name before.
He was, yeah. He certainly was. And
but it was his wife was involved too.
His wife was involved, you know, behind every good man is a good woman.
Because every picture you showed us was the couple, was the both of them.
It was always Owen and Dolly Pope. Yeah.
Well, it was six ponies. Come on.
Yeah, you need help.
I think Dolly kept him in line, you know.
And now he actually came out here to Disney World too, right?
He did. You know, he was asked to come out by actually Roy, you know, if he did such a good job starting, you know, the horses and the horse program in California, there was nobody else they could think to ask to come out here. So they asked Owen and Dolly if they would come out and start the horse program. And at that time was their dream of starting Walt Disney World, and they accepted.
Now, when we were at the World Percheron Congress last year, which was a whole lot of fun, and one of the things we saw in the museum, and we had heard this when we were out touring Disneyland, the stables out there at Disneyland, was that they actually showed the Percheron hitches at one time in shows. They took them out, right? You were telling us about that too.
They did. They used to go all over the country and compete. And the year that they retired, they were like the world champions. And so that's when you quit.
Right.
So nobody beats you.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's when you retire your hitch and you say, we're done. All right.
I used to do eights, right?
Eight. Yeah. The most we've done in the last few years has just been the six. But yeah, we have gone out with eight.
Do you drive the sixes?
I do.
That's a lot of reins.
There is a lot. Yeah, there is. Yeah, but they're all really good. By the time we're competing with these guys, they are so good.
Right.
And they're so responsive. And we know them so well. We know where we want to put them. I remember when Mark came up and asked me, Gary, we need you to drive the Citrus Bowl Parade. I says, okay, very good. He says, do you have a lineup of who you'd like to use? Mm-hmm. Oh, man, I just, you know, named off six horses where I was going to put them. And, you know, and he goes, oh, okay. He says, okay.
Right. You know who you need as leaders?
Yeah.
And who you need as the wheelers?
The wheelers and the swing. We knew exactly where I was going to put everybody and why.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's what they want to hear. You know, a little theory behind what we want to do.
Mm-hmm. Right. How long does it take one of your Percherons or draft horses of any breed to, before they would, let's say, be safe enough to go down Main Street?
Well, again, you know,
depends on the horse.
It's as you know, horse people, we all know that you can't really put a time frame on it, you know, because sometimes when we buy these horses, we're not raising them. We usually buy them 3-4 years of age. So what we usually find out once we do purchase these horses is sometimes there's some sort of background that we've got to kind of work through.
Oh, we all know about the horses that we bought.
Yeah. We always say that he's a clean slate. Well,
there's
not really. We've only had two with the clean slate that I know of, and that's been Jacob and Skyler, because we raised them as babies.
Right.
So they were actually probably one of our most, I don't want to say easiest, because maybe that's not quite the word I want to say, but because they had a clean slate, and we knew them, and we started them as babies, hooking them, training them, and going down the road was probably one of the most smoothest sailing operations we've done in a long time, you know?
It just takes time for them to grow up.
Yeah, it's it. Yeah.
That's why we don't do it.
Yeah, Skylar's 5 years old, you know. So 5 years we've had him before we feel like, okay, now he can do wagon rides, you know.
All right, I'm going to tease the audience again. We're going to talk about Jacob in a minute because, we're going to tease. We're going to wait on that for a little bit yet.
He's
because
close to my heart.
Oh, yeah. Ours too after last night. Oh, so
yes. It's pretty special.
Yeah, we'll talk about Jacob in a second because, but, you know, one of the things too that, you talked about was in the original Disneyland, they actually had a mule train. Tell us about that.
They did. You know, part of when they opened Disneyland, they had over 250 animals on property, everything from, you know, carriage horses to ponies, but they also had mules because Frontierland was supposed to depict the old frontier.
Because Walt loved Western everything.
He loved everything Western. Yeah. He loved it. And that was a land that was, I think all of them were dear to his heart in one way or the other, certainly. But, you know, that was very much who he was. And so they had a mule train ride where those mules were tied nose to tail. And there was mule skinner in the front and one in the back. And they would take them up through the hills of Frontierland.
There's a term that you don't hear very often anymore either, mule skinner. Some people are going, they skinned the mules. No, that's not what that means. They were the guides.
They were the guides. Exactly. Thank you for clarifying that.
Well, it's not a term you hear anymore.
It isn't. Yeah. No, but that was what their title was. And they would take those mules, like I said, through the hills, and it was an attraction,
you know, to ride.
And probably a little safer than that ride down the Grand Canyon, which I'm not doing.
But it's so fun to see those old photographs, you know, that people still have in their archives and will share with us and send us. They'll be going through their old pictures and they're like, oh my goodness, this is us at Disneyland on the horses, on the Conestoga wagons, on the, they had Conestoga wagons, they had Yosemite wagons, they had stage coaches that guests could ride in.
So this was before they had the rides that we see now. They had equestrian rides.
They did, you know, and eventually those cycled out because for a lot of different reasons, they did, as other rides and new technology became a little bit more exciting, and taking care of 250 head of horses and mules is a lot, and ride capacity, you know, that's they can only carry so many people. But
well, for our driving audience, and this fascinated Wendy and I yesterday, is the fact that they made the harness and tell us about that.
They did.
And, and the stagecoach.
Owen was incredibly
This
talented.
Is Owen Pope again.
Owen Pope again. You know, he was tasked not only to buy all of those animals and hire all of those incredible people that, you know, were driving those stagecoaches and, you know, the taking the mule rides out, he was tasked with making the equipment. So he made and oversaw the actual harness making and the carriages. He had his hand in along with the Imagineers who helped out making those ride vehicles.
It makes sense though, you know, because it's a movie company.
So, I mean, they had wheelwrights that were there making these wheels.
Like to see
it's
the
art.
Number of people that go into making a movie, the prop guys and all that. So, I mean, it makes sense that they do that, but it just seems like an overwhelming task.
Especially making the harness. I mean, that's an art in itself.
It is. Yeah. And they had beautiful harness, you know, and you have to remember Owen was hired several years before the park opened, actually, to start this whole project.
Yeah, it would take a long time.
We always like to say it not only started with the horse, but Owen probably was one of the first people hired specifically for the park.
Right. Can you tell us a little bit about the 5/8 scale concept?
Well, you know, everything, you know, it in the park is kind of a 5/8 scale. Mm-hmm. It's made to, when you go in, that you look a little bit bigger, everything's a little bit smaller. And that's what, when Owen was showing his ponies, that was what first, inspired them to ask him to come. They were interested in those little ponies that size to be part of the park. They thought that that would work good. Right. You know, movie sets are always a little bit smaller. Mm-hmm. And when they got the ponies there, they realized the ponies actually were too small.
Yeah.
For the stagecoach.
So we actually used draft horses.
Went completely the other direction.
Completely opposite direction.
It was funny seeing those pictures, though, because you see all the little ponies lined up in the stagecoach. It was cute.
And Owen did make a stagecoach. We did have stagecoaches mm-hmm. for those ponies for a long time. And we have actual photos of Walt on the back lot of the studios with some of his probably, you know, his staff that worked in the studio at that time.
Well, hi, Charlie. Welcome to our special. We're so happy to have you as our first guest today.
Well, I'm honored to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Now, Glenn, let me stop you. You do not address him as Charlie. You address him as Mr. Daniels, okay?
No. You're wrong. No, Charlie. Everybody, even little kids call me Charlie. I prefer it. Okay. My daddy's name is Mr. Daniels, and I never forgot that, but I'm Charlie.
Well, you know why I think I can call him Charlie is because I saw you at the Grand Ole Opry for the first time at the Ryman Auditorium. So anybody that sees you there can call you Charlie, in my opinion.
That's absolutely right. Anybody didn't see me there in commentary, too.
So let me ask you this. With your tour schedule, which is incredible, do you still get time to get back to Twin Pines Ranch and the horses and ride and do all that?
I don't do as much as I used to. I haven't roped in a long time. I used to do a lot of game roping. But of course, age has something to do with that, too. I'm not as able to just get up in the morning, go jump on a horse and stay all day as I used to be. But I still enjoy getting on. I got a couple of nice old using horses that I say old, they're not so old, but the boys are pretty careful about what they let me ride anymore. I'm in Leroy here. You know, they got one busted down pretty good before I get on him. And I do get a chance to ride. We'll go out and I'll get together with guys. We'll go out and spend a while riding once in a while up there. I still enjoy it very much.
Now, this special is all about everybody's favorite horsey holiday memories at Christmas time. Did you get to spend a lot of Christmases at the ranch? Would you go out and ride? Was that part of the tradition?
I'm always going to be home at Christmas time. That's the one thing. I'm going to have all my people. I got a lot of married people with kids and grandkids with me. And I'm going to be there, and they're going to be there at Christmas. If no other time of the year, we're going to be there at Christmas, always. And I used to do quite a bit of riding around Christmas time because that was my time off. And, I would get together with the guys and go out and ride. Cold weather riding's fun, you know. You bundle up real good. I remember one time I came home from Hawaii, and I was my time was all boogered up like it always is when you come out of those time zones. And I had laid down and took a nap. And I woke up, it was just starting to get twilight, and it was snowing. And I said, I got to get on a horse. So I called out in the morning. I said, you guys got anything to do in the back pasture? And y'all woke them up to something. I said, how about selling me up something? Sell up old fat guy, I'll be down in a minute. I did, and we rode back. And riding when it's snowing, I mean, not a blizzard, but when it's just kind of, you know, when snow's kind of coming down, and you hear the horses who is kind of padding on top of it. And that is a wonderful experience. Anybody's never done it, I'll highly recommend it.
Yeah, it is. It truly is. Now, do you live, do you have a house at the ranch, or is the house separate
from
the
ranch?
Yeah, okay.
No. I live on the ranch. That's my home. I've been there for 35 years, something like that now.
Tell us about the ranch. I'm curious to know, where is it? And, tell us a little bit about what goes on there.
It's in Wilson County, Tennessee, about 30 miles east of Nashville, off of Interstate 40.
Yeah.
As far as what goes on there, we have been through several phases. Our main interest was horses for quite a long time. And we went through, using horses, basically roping horses and that sort of thing. And we got into cutting horses pretty heavy for a while. Did a lot of breeding down at the Ken Ranch and had some really good cutting blood on our place. But basically now we are actually more into cattle, into horned Herefords right now than we are horses. We keep horses. We still stand in a stud and we're still dealing in horses, but we raise a lot of cattle. Cattle prices have gone up, as I'm sure you're aware of, tremendously here in the last little while. So we get into them. So we'll always have some horses. Always have some good horses around.
Did your kids get into it?
Oh, yeah, my son did. My whole family did, my wife and myself. And in fact, even before we had the ranch, we got into horseback riding. We used to have to lease. Well, not so much lease, but just rent a place to, you know, to keep them, to board them, used to board them. And what's one of the main things that we went looking for, our own place, our own, with some acreage, that was one of the main things that we wanted. We wanted some place to go and ride our horses. And before we even moved to Twin Pines, there was a double wide trailer out there. And we used to go out and spend the weekend there and ride. That was a big deal with my whole family.
So you married well, then. You got a woman that'll spend her weekend in a double wide. She must like horses.
Oh, yeah. She's awesome. Spent a weekend anywhere. I mean, I'm the same with her. We've been married 51 years, so
we're
getting
along
pretty good.
Yeah, I would say. I bet horses and having the ranch and having the family around really, really helps all of that, too, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was a great way for us to spend time together. Of course, at the time, we didn't think so much about it. It was just a natural part of our lives. It's what we all enjoyed doing, is make sure everybody had a good riding horse and, you know, just go out and saddle up and ride around the property and enjoy ourselves. But it was just such a natural thing for us to do. We didn't think about it so much as recreation as we did. It was just part of our lives.
It's a lifestyle, absolutely. Now, I gotta thank you, because for two reasons. I'm a Georgia-born girl. I grew up in Georgia, and I'm now in an Air Force family. And obviously, I think to enter the high school system in Georgia...
Charlie, she's understating it. Her husband is an F-16 fighter pilot, so...
Mercy.
Yes, he's really cool. But what I was going to say, Glenn, is that to enter the high school system in Georgia, you actually have to recite and sing all lyrics from Devil Went Down to Georgia. So I passed that test. And I could still do it. I knew you were coming on. It's been in my head for days. You just you don't get into school if you don't you don't have any friends if you don't know every lyric to Devil Went Down to Georgia.
Oh, and mercy. Where's your husband stationed, by the way?
We're in Phoenix, Arizona right now. There's no riding in the snow here, but we hope to retire. When he retires, we'll be going to Oklahoma. We already bought about 12 acres there, so we're ready to do what you're doing.
Well, I'm married to an Okie. My wife's from Tulsa.
She's from Tulsa? Oh, my gosh.
She's from Tulsa. Yeah, absolutely.
Well,
my son was born at Hillcrest Medical Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
No kidding.
I got to deep roots in Oklahoma. Oh, yeah, we used to live there. We were married there, like I said, 51 years ago. So,
oh, my gosh.
Deep roots in Oklahoma.
No kidding. Happy anniversary. We're just going to have to be best friends now, because obviously we have so much in common.
Absolutely.
But I wanted to thank you, too, for all that you do for the troops. I know you're really supportive of our military, and I do appreciate that.
Well, it is an honor to support our military. I've done it all my life. I was 5 years old when Pearl Harbor was bombed, and my formative years were during the Second World War. And the war was very serious to us, because I lived on in a seaport town, and we had shipping going over to Europe to the war effort, and they were sunk just off our coast by German U-boats, and sometimes it was so close, I never saw it, but I've heard some of the grown people said that it was so close at times you could see the fires of battle from our beaches. So we took the war very seriously. We never knew what the Nazis might try to bring it on shore, and I learned, I say this every night to the crowd, I learned very early in my life that only two things protect America, and that's the grace of God and the United States military. It's that way being it. Be that way, it's that way now, and it will be that way as long as we remain a free and sovereign nation. So I'm very beholden to the military. I always have been, always will be.
Well, I just appreciate you showing that to them as well. But I got to ask you, being the you're a Grammy Award winning singer, you must have a favorite Christmas song that you sing with the family. I don't know, at Christmas time, you sing it to your grandkids, anything like that?
I don't so much sing, but a song that has been part of my wife will put, we have Christmas records. Of course, I've got three Christmas records, that's what we play them. But
they get to hear you
always,
record.
Always been part of Christmas in our house is Nat King Cole's Christmas song, the Chestnut Roasting song. I can't imagine Christmas without it. It's just natural. I mean, to walk in a house and She does an incredible job at decorating. She has 5 Christmas trees, and she just really gets into it. And it's just we're a very traditional family. We have traditions that we do year after year, and one of them is, you know, doing a lot of decorating and putting the music on and listening to it. And that song, if I had to name one song, it would probably be that one.
Wow.
I always wondered if a family like of an artist like yourself, of a singer and a musician, if those families sit around the tree at Christmas time and actually sing Christmas songs, or does that not happen because you're tired of singing?
Well, it's not because we get tired of singing. I just don't. It's just not something we particularly do. I mean, yeah. We break out and sing a song or something, but not in any kind of an organized way or anything.
Right.
You know, it's okay. Not really part of our Christmas tradition to sing, you know, sing gospel songs. Going to church on Christmas Eve always is.
Yeah.
We go to early service on Christmas Eve, and we come back, and we get back home. Our early service starts about 4 in the afternoon or something. We get back home. We always have a bunch of people over for Christmas Eve, and something we've been doing for a lot of years. That's part of our tradition, and you know, just things that we do year after year after year, and it just wouldn't seem like Christmas time without them.
So I've got to ask you, Charlie, Mr. Daniels. So if I've got a 2-year-old and he's just 2.5 now, so we're starting to realize that he's going to start to understand what Christmas is. And what do you think the one most important tradition that you guys do is? Because my husband and I are trying to kind of start to figure out what we're going to do on a yearly basis. What really means a lot to your family?
Having your son. Is it a boy, you said?
It's a little boy, son? Yes, sir.
Okay, teaching your son what the true meaning of Christmas is. It's the birth of Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't teach him, he's not going to know. The world's not going to teach him, but that's what it's about. That's what we try to remember at my house. That's what we try to keep first and foremost, is this is the celebrating the birth of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. That's what we're doing this for, no matter what anybody else wants to call it. If they want to say Merry Christmas or not, or they want whatever they want to do, we will follow our traditions and we will follow our beliefs. And the truth of the matter is, this is Christ's birthday, so let's keep that first and foremost. It's the most important thing you can teach him.
Oh, I don't think we can add anything to that. Thank you,
right.
Charlie Daniels, for joining us and leading off our horsey holiday celebration for 12 hours live today. We appreciate you stopping by, and I hope you get a ride in this year on Christmas.
Thank you so much. God bless, and a Merry Christmas.